Welcome everyone to the May 17th rescheduled Water Resources and Watershed Committee meeting. Before we start, let me read some announcements. This meeting is being conducted in person at the Engineering Services section, boardroom. As a convenience to the public, members of the public may also participate virtually by logging into the agency Zoom meeting. Any member of the public may listen to the meeting or make comments to the committee using the call-in number or Zoom webinar link. In the event there is a disruption of service which prevents the agency from broadcasting the meeting to members of the public using either the call-in option or internet-based service, this meeting will not be postponed or rescheduled, but will continue without remote participation. The remote participation option is being provided as a convenience to the public and is not required. Members of the public are welcome to attend the meeting in person. Participate in public comment from your computer, tablet, or smartphone. When I announce the agenda item you wish to speak on, click the raised hand feature in Zoom. You will be notified when it's your turn to speak. Please unmute when requested. To participate in public comment via phone, when I announce the agenda item you wish to speak on, dial *9 to raise your hand. Note, phone participants will be called on by the last two digits of their phone number or by name. When it's your turn to speak, dial *6 to unmute. For those attending in person, there's common cards out in the front. We received one already, so thank you for that. The procedure for tonight's meeting are as follows. I will introduce each agenda item. Staff will present. I will ask for public comments. I will then ask for discussion and questions from committee members. Then the committee then comes to a consensus to move an item to the board for consideration. Any PowerPoints shown at tonight's meeting will be posted to the SCV Water website. This time, all committee members are in attendance, and we'll start with Pledge of Allegiance. President Martin, would you lead us in Pledge of Allegiance?
You be an honor. Please, face the flag, put your hand over your heart. Ready, begin.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, President Martin. We'll move on to item two, public comment. We do have a public comment from Ms. Noldmeyer. Are we ready for the timer? Ms. Noldmeyer, go ahead.
Yes, the reason I waited till now was just to see how you would handle the fact when you're going to have to face the water not being drinkable for anyone. And that's the way we saw it a long time ago. And we've been buying our water. And I noticed you're kind of cautious about drinking, that even now, probably that isn't out of the faucet. But I've been very disappointed in the agency and how they've handled this. And that project after project be approved, built, and how you took over all the water supply at the very worst time. I don't know who did it in their groundwork on that, but that, or you put it, the ratepayers responsible for everything now. That's actually what you did. And we've been watching it. We don't drink the water. I don't cook with it for years. And I've been watching how it developed. When there would be someone that would stand up there and say, we should get whoever created this mess. But no one did forget it. In fact, you took responsibility of the mess yourself. I know some of you are new, but that's exactly what happened. Now it's the water peers that are going to be stuck with. And you're still doing it. You're still doing it to certain developments. And do you really think that is going to be drinkable water? Or are you going to say they have to get their own supply? I see maybe you're drinking it, maybe you're not. But I kind of watched the display that went on to the years. Not this there's anything funny about it, because there isn't, because it makes people sick. And I think it's gotten past the point of you really doing anything for the benefit of the ratepayers. And it'll be interesting how you go about it and how you tell the people whether they should be drinking that water or not, especially if they have young children. It's not good for anyone, but and it's, I haven't seen even a spark of that. And we got one big developer, you know, that is just waiting to get his project going. And I thought, sure, I can see why. But that's just why I'm very disappointed in
our elected officials.
Thank you.
Yes, Stoltmeyer, thank you for your statement. Just to clear up comments being made, water quality reports are available on our website for the past couple of years now. The most recent one was from 2022. It's water. Our water is drinkable. Every director here that's on this committee lives in the jurisdiction of city water. My two young kids drink the water. Thanks, everyone. Okay. Moving forward to item number three, status of groundwater recharge initiatives presented by Ernesto Vasquez and Rick Vergutz.
Good evening, everyone. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Perfect. Let me share my screen here. Share. All right, going into presentation mode. Can everyone see the screen okay?
Yes.
Perfect. All right, so thank you everyone for your time tonight. My nose is very swollen tonight, so at any point if you need me to repeat anything, please let me know and I'll make sure everyone knows what I'm saying. Anyway. Let's get started. I'll provide you a status of the groundwater recharge studies. I'll first go through some background on the recharge projects just as a refresher, and then I'll provide you the updates on the most recent activities for the recharge studies. And these studies are coming to a close, so we'll move on to next steps on work that we anticipate doing, that we'd like to do in the near future. And I do have some bonus content for you tonight. Ali asked me to put together some groundwater levels so that we can take a look at that since we've had a good amount of water over the last couple months. So I'll finish off with some graphs. I'm learning a program called Microsoft Power BI. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, but it is a Microsoft data visualization software. And I felt there was no better way to learn than take some actual data and see what I can do with it. So the graphics are very basic and I'm on the free version still. She's helping me get with the pro version, but I anticipate having more capabilities later. But for now, I think it's just neat to share recent data. So getting started. So the recharge study updates, as you may recall, we have two locations for the recharge study, the Castaic portion and the Pine Tree portion. The Castaic portion was completed late last year. And if you recall, the conclusion of that study showed that we learned that the site can support about 5,000 acre feet per year of recharge, which is absolutely fantastic. There was a caveat, however, that during wet years, we would have to monitor the water table just to make sure that water doesn't surface downstream during wet years, as the water table is usually a bit more elevated during those years. But on average, about 5,000 acre feet of recharge can be supported at that site. The Pine Tree location, which is what I'm going to focus on tonight, is we're finishing up the work there. It's been a lot of work to get up to this point, but I'm happy to report that we're about 75% done. And I'm also happy to report that we completed the field activities just last week, May 11th. So I have some pictures to show you in the upcoming slides. We were able to finish the borehole testing and the infiltration sampling. And I'm, you know, just a lot of work in order to get to that point, a lot of coordination between departments. And I'm just really excited. This is almost to a close here. So let me show you some pictures of the Pine Tree Project. But first, let's orient ourselves. On the right-hand side here, this is the Pine Tree location of the portion of the recharge studies. So it's all one location. It's located just south of Soledad Canyon in the 14, near the Oak Springs Canyon intersection. If you're not sure exactly where that is, maybe you're familiar with the Sand Canyon exit off the 14. And this is just past that, just east of that, is in this area here. So the red squares are the three areas where we did the infiltration and borehole testing. And the black path is the routes that we took in order to reach the sites. And they are existing paths that our operations personnel uses for collecting production information, well maintenance, things like that. So that way we can minimally disturb any wildlife in the river. So going on to pictures. So this is a picture that I took of the Santa Clara River, and you can see one of the pine tree wells there in the background. Not part of the study, but you know, it's been a while since I've seen water flowing in any significant amount during the river, and I thought it was really, really neat to see. And as you can see, the cloud coverage as well. We couldn't have asked for better weather during field days. Just not too hot, not too cold. Don't have to worry too much about being sunburned. And it was a perfect week for doing some field work. So here we have the infiltration portion of the study. And you can see the big hole here on the bottom right. And we have some operations crew helping out with the backhoe and the water truck. And really, I want to take a moment here and really thank our operations team. Coordinating with them and having them offering to help us out and have some staff available to help out with the water truck operation, to help with the backhoe operation, to help with scheduling the dig alerts and everything. You know, we really couldn't have done it without them. We really appreciate the operations team and all their help in this study. But here you see we have the test pit excavated, and within that test pit, I don't know if you can see my cursor, but we have a wooden structure, and that wooden structure GSI was able to build so that we could focus the recharge to within the bottom area of this wooden structure. And you know, we took that as lessons learned from our castaic portion. As soon as you introduce water, the walls start deforming, and you don't have a good nice straight area for doing your calculations. So having this wooden structure really helped us, keep the walls from caving in and making sure that we're getting good data. Additionally, you see at the bottom here, you have a transducer. We have one outside taking the barometric pressure and one inside with the water filled, so that it can they can plug into a computer program afterwards and really calculate the infiltration rate for this portion of the study. We also did some borehole testing. And for this, we use a limited access rig. On the top left here, you can see the limited access rig coming off of the truck. And if you recall, during the castaic portion, we did have a really big drill rig going out there, but there was really no issues with access. And here we wanted to make sure that we could stay on the existing paths and really do minimal disturbance only to the work areas. And this drill rig, even though it looks big, it's really smaller than a pickup truck. So it's hand operated, and they were able to wheel it to the site by hand. So here on the top right, getting the site prepared for the drilling. On the bottom right, we have the drill rig, actually the auger moving and lifting out the dirt. And we went down about 40 feet. And on the bottom left here, you can see the borehole samples. GSI was logging the soil content. They were recording soil moisture, the particle size, the color of the soil. They were taking some samples and putting it into this box for later testing, for lab testing, and just for records. But What we found, we still need, there's still some additional analysis that needs to be done, but preliminary results show that there was a lot of sand and a lot of, it wasn't quite gravel, but it was pretty coarse material. And it looks like it's going to be a great site for recharge. So preliminary results are looking great. And then next steps. So this study is part of the GSP grant. So we do need to finish up this report. We're planning on receiving a final report in mid-June. All that's really left to do is just do the data analysis, the modeling. We're expecting a draft within the next couple of weeks, and we're hoping to have all this wrapped up by mid-June so that we can submit that final grant report to DWR before the end of June so we can submit that for reimbursement. So long time coming, almost there, almost to the finish line, and we're excited for that. The next step after that, of course, we do need to wait for the pine tree report to be done so we can go through that. But next plans are we would like to develop a scope for full-scale implementation of the recharge projects. That would include looking into, you know, what kind of permits would we need, an engineering analysis of how do we get water to the site, construction and maintenance costs, just doing a cost analysis, potentially exploring an agreement with downstream partners regarding maybe cost sharing, things like that. And that, in addition to that, you know, using our Goldstone model to investigate impacts of local recharge on our water supply portfolio, things of that sort. So a lot of exciting stuff coming up, a lot of work to get to this point, but excited to share those achievements with you. And now for the bonus slides, I do want to pause before going through the additional slides. If there are any questions that I can answer, happy to answer that.
Well, let's say you go to the bonus slide. We want to respect the protocol we have. We would have to go through public comment. So,
of course. Okay.
Just continue, please.
You got it. So keep in mind, I'm still learning the software. I have to manually input a lot of the data. So we only have about the last year and a half worth of data. It's not enough to make, not enough to see the long-term trends, but it is still just interesting to see our precipitation and water level for the last year and a half. So on the top here, we have the monthly totals of rainfall and precipitation in inches. So you can see in January 2022 on the top left, we had about 1.7 inches of rain, not so much the rest of 2022. And then during November through March of 2023, a substantial amount of rain. And you can see the cumulative precipitation by month on the bottom graph. So the rate of change in precipitation, you can see towards the early part of this year, late part of last year, in total over the last year and a half, receiving almost 35, 36 inches of rain. And this is a weird time frame to look at regarding precipitation, but I was trying to keep it apples to apples with the alluvial well level data set. So that's the reason we have this year and a half worth of data here. Now for the alluvial aquifer, there we have two graphs. So let me take you through the top one first. The top one, if you look at the leftmost value, the 44.4, that represents the average water level of all alluvial wells during that month. So it's an average of all wells. And by doing that, we can take the average on a monthly basis to see how the alluvial aquifer is trending throughout the year. And you can see during 2022, the alluvial aquifer was slowly decreasing. And when the rain hit during the early part of this year, late part of last year, you can see a dramatic increase in the average water levels throughout the alluvium. On the bottom portion, we have the sum of production by month. So it's production values by month. So you can see in January 2022, all alluvial pumping was about 900 acre feet for the month. And you can see that trend as it goes throughout the year. And of course, you know, the early part of this year with a lot of rain and a fantastic allocation. We have reduced pumping and just taking a look at that trend for the last year and a half or so. So we do have hydrographs for single wells, but this is the average for all wells. Same with the Saugus. Saugus, this is a same format. We have the average water levels for all Saugus wells for the last year and a half. You can see that trend with the lowest value being in September 22, and then some recovery, and really the biggest jump in the recovery being that December through January value with precipitation there. And then same on the bottom, sum of production by month. You can see that the pumping of the Saugus from month to month, with it peaking in around August, and then a decrease in pumping the later half of the year. So with that, you know, that is average information for all wells. We can, I can produce hydrographs for single wells that are really, really great. But I just wanted to quickly finish up with some future basin monitoring effort. You know, as part of the resiliency initiative, looking at doing some geologic mapping of the recharge areas, and the power of using the average on the last slide is you can kind of see what the whole basin is doing as a whole, but they are average levels, and some wells benefit more than others. And by doing this geologic mapping of the recharge areas, can really target which wells will have the most benefit, where those areas are, get a better idea of how water's flowing within our basin, and really allow us to make better informed decisions, improve our modeling, and really just provide a net benefit by doing that work. So with that, happy to answer any questions regarding any part of the presentation. And I know most people don't sign up for bonus slides, but I hope you at least found that informative and interesting.
Very good. Before we open up to the committee, any questions from the public?
No.
Okay. Questions, comments from the committee?
I really like the graphs. I like the idea of averaging out what all of the alluvial wells are doing. I'm really surprised to see the Saugus respond so quick. It's very surprising.
Yep, I agree.
Dr. Marks?
Yeah. Great presentation, Ernesto, and like Bill was, I just get a sense of just how much the Tawak further responded to this year. I mean, 20-30 feet increase in those aquifers, that's a lot of water. Still, any estimates that staff has done to say how much storage has increased in the basement water? We're still looking at that.
Yep. Thank you. Thank you.
If I can answer that. Thank you for the question. We are looking into that right now, using our groundwater model, looking into how much storage. We looked at the observed data right now, but then we wanted to translate that into how much storage is that reflected into the aquifer. So that's work. We're still working on that.
Thanks. Interesting to see that.
Yeah.
Thanks, Alin.
How can that be presented to us, available storage? How would that be visualized? I'm curious.
That will be kind of a water budget analysis, showing how much inflow, how much outflow in the basin, and then how much is change in storage. That's how we're going to present it. And I think in the past that's how it's presented to the committees, is a change in the storage from the water balance of the
like a static value of acre feet of water that we can put in there. Would that also be shown to us? Okay.
That could be done. It could be done in acre feet so that you can see the change in the storage between, as example, the beginning of the year and until the end of the year. We know how much water came into the aquifer, how much water taken out of the aquifer, and then you can follow the change in the storage, and that's what the change of storage as a result of these storms.
And I get these questions from people regarding injection wells. I know we're not really the prime area for that, but has that been a possibility, like right next to Castaic Lake or on the river somewhere? Is that something that we explored?
I can take that one. Orzechowski. Director Cooper's right. There have been a couple studies over history in the basin about actually trying to inject water. And the main aquifer that was tested in was the Saugus Aquifer, right? Because the challenge is if you just put it in the alluvium, you know, it's moving.
Yeah.
So that's part of, you know, the stuff that Ernesto is pointing out here is that we need to really think about when you put the water in and how you put it in, because we want to make sure we're getting the value of that exercise. But there have been tests about actually injecting the water. A lot of the time, the challenge is what kind of water you inject. So typically, they don't like you injecting untreated water straight into the aquifer, right? It's the aquifer that actually helps filter out, you know, the different impurities of water, storm water, whatever it is, as it goes down through. So the challenge is, yeah, what water would you put in? You could probably put treated surface water in. I think, you know, part of the resiliency effort, we're going to start looking at those kinds of questions about how potentially to further optimize groundwater storage and groundwater recovery out of our basin. So that's one of those things on the list that we're trying to understand better and test those types of possibilities.
Okay, thank you. All right, we have no other questions or comments. Thank you for the presentation. Appreciate the Power BI graphs. Please explore that because it seems like even the private sector is using that too.
My pleasure. Thank you. Thank you for your time.
All right.
Mr. Chair, I just want to add one thing to the presentation. I think one of the things that I wanted to acknowledge here is the conjunctive use strategy that we have in the organization, the agency, as well as the adaptive management that our staff working with the operations, working with SARA, working with the operations. We are having a weekly meeting with operations to make sure that, and you see that our production went down, as Sarah mentioning to them that we're getting more surface water, more imported water from the State Water Project. And I think that's adaptive management. I think we really need to acknowledge that. The working closely with operations, working closely with Rickford Goods with regard to the GSP, working closely with the with also the imported water and the operations, knowing how much we are pumping this month, how much we are going to reduce it, helped us a lot, helped us in creating this internal dynamic that's helping us into managing our resources in really one of the best ways. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, that's good. That's good to hear. Definitely appreciate the teamwork here at SCB Water. Okay, moving on to item 4.1, status of water supplies presented by Sarah Flory. Glass is half full.
Now her glass is full.
Yeah, no, it's overflow.
It's way too full. Okay, is my screen good?
Yep, you're good to go.
And you can hear me okay? Okay, well, thank you for having me this evening, and I'm going to be doing a status of water supply update for you tonight. Nice. We're going to go through snowpack and reservoirs, a climate pattern shift, and then talk about our allocations and operations updates. Shouldn't be too long. So as I'm sure you've all heard, there's just a lot of snow that still needs to melt. The little graphic on the left-hand side, you can see the purple line that basically shows where we're at. It is indicating statewide snowpack, where we're at in comparison to our historical average. And so you can see we're still almost like over 1.5 times more than our peak in April to melt, maybe some more than that. And then on the right-hand side, it breaks it down into northern, central, and southern Sierras. And the blue line is what's indicating where we're at currently for all of those years. But again, just huge amounts of snow to still melt. And this is all as of May 15th, so 2 days ago. So we've kind of just gotten into that season of melting. Wow. And so did you have a question?
No, I'm just shocked at the graphic right now.
Yeah, I don't know if we'll ever see this again. So soak it in. every drop counts that we can use. So with regards to the reservoirs, you know, a great story. The reservoirs are all looking really full. You can see at the top here, Shasta and Orville are basically filled up. If a reservoir is not filled up as of this point in time, it will be filled up by the time the snow stops melting. Even Castaics, 96% of capacity. It's pretty full right now. The reservoirs kind of at the bottom there that look more empty. The reason for that is that they're smaller and they're taking in a lot of flows right now. And so they're still being managed for flood control to make sure that all of the snow that's melting has a place to go in an orderly manner, I guess. So I'll get into that a little more on the next slide. So, this is a graphic that they shared at the last operations committee meeting. And what it shows us is reservoir conditions and anticipated snow melt. It is as of April 27th, so the beginning, right at the end of last month. But what you can see in the blue graphics are the reservoir storage levels in volume. And then right to the right of that, you'll see like a snowflake bar, I guess, which is representing the volume of remaining snow melt in those areas. And then you also can see there's little arrows at the bottom. It shows the flows coming into the reservoir, and that was as of April 27th, and then the flows going out. So there's a lot of water that's being melted right now. A lot of it is going in and going back out because the reservoirs are pretty filled up. And then what I think is really interesting from this graphic is that there's a lot of areas where the volume of snow that's melting is more than 1, 2, and sometimes 3 times the amount of reservoir volume that's available in that area. So just kind of gives you an idea of how much snow there still is to melt and the volume of that water that's coming down these mountains. The inflows are changing daily. And so since this graphic was made, you know, we kind of had that cool period, which is great because it kind of slows things down. But now it's warming up again. And so there's a lot of flood control discussions going on and a lot of water is going to start coming down the mountains. In addition, DWR actually is we've read an article that says they opened up the intertie that can bring Kern River flows into the aqueduct to help mitigate some of that flood flow. So they're testing that intertie. It hasn't been open for 17 years, I believe. So a lot of staff has never experienced this. And right now they're discussing water quality, things like that. But this is, you know, just another way that more water can come into the system and benefit the state water project. So as well as helping with flood flows. So pretty interesting year, lots of new things happening. And in this, though, we're, you know, shifting, our climatic conditions are shifting or have shifted. We've gone from 3 years of straight La Nina, which means all the storms get pushed up north and it historically tends to be drier. And we had some pretty epic drought conditions the last few years. And then we did have quite a wet season. So, you know, La Nina does tend to have its historical trends, but sometimes random things happen. And so this winter was one of those times where we kind of shifted out of La Nina And that we had a lot of precipitation, so that jet stream came down. We are now moving into El Nino conditions, which the models are showing that it could start this month into July, and I've heard peak in December. And what that means historically in El Nino is that the jet stream kind of comes down. We get a lot more precipitation throughout the state of California through the winter. And but one other thing is that the temperatures are going to be warmer. So what the state climatologist has told us is that it could be similar storms that we've seen this year, where you get back-to-back atmospheric rivers. But one of the differences is that it's not going to be as cold. So it'll be a lot more precipitation versus the large amounts of snow that we saw this year. So again, a random year could happen and it could be very dry, but this is, you know, just something to think about as we're planning for next year. And we've had another allocation increase. So in towards the end of April, we did shift to 100% allocation. This has not happened since 2006. So we actually get all of our state water project water this year. That's 95,200 acre feet. It is more than our entire demand. Our demand is set around 66,500 acre feet this year. So we have a lot of water to manage. And so my glass is like full 2.5 times, I'd say. It's going to create some challenges, but we're figuring out what we're going to do with that water to make it the most beneficial as we can. As has been mentioned, we did reduce our groundwater pumping. We started that in February. We could kind of give our aquifer a chance to recharge from those droughts and then also take advantage of all the imported supply that we had available. We're doing everything we can to make sure that we're still thinking about potential worst case scenarios in 2024 and planning to make sure that we have some cushion if things go dry again. Right now, we're looking to have our carryover goal be about 15,000 acre feet in storage at the beginning of next year. And then in addition, we're looking to have about 35,000 acre feet of surplus water that we're going to be looking for new programs for, see what we can do. And I'll get into that a little bit more in a minute. The final March deliveries from DWR did show that we spilled about 2,600 acre feet, which I'm super bummed about. I thought we nailed it, but we didn't. But I'll take 2,600 acre feet of spill any day over the potential like 17,000 that we started with. So it's still a good story. We are going to be maximizing our recharge into our water banks. So 25,000 acre feet will be going back into our water banks to bring those supplies back up. And then in April, because Director Marks had such a wonderful idea that he suggested, we were able to convince DWR to allow us to receive Article 21 water. And the reason that we are able to do that, Article 21 cannot technically substitute our Table A deliveries, but because we reduced our groundwater pumping, which means that we have to bring in a little bit more Table A to cover those that change in production, we're able to supplement that with Article 21. So we started doing that right at the end of April. And we have continued to do that since, and we're averaging about 150 acre feet per week from Article 21 deliveries. I've heard that the Article 21 could potentially be available through June, maybe longer. So we can continue grabbing that water a little bit at a time, but it's nice that we've been able to use our conjunctive use strategies and take advantage of some of that extra water. And thank you, Director Marks, for that idea. Appreciate it. And so onto our operating plan. There's a lot on this slide. So basically, I've got some details about the scenarios in the table to the left. I've got the 2023 operating plan updated in blue there. And that's assuming 100% allocation, we've got our reduced groundwater production totals for the year. It takes into account our Article 56 carryover that's spilled, the Article 21 water usage. It shows that we're putting the full amount of recharge into both of our banking programs. Also shows the exchange that we did with Metropolitan. And then it assumes about 7.5% conservation demand reduction. So we are still getting the benefit of our conservation programs being intact and still lots of outreach going on. And so we're assuming about, you know, just around 5,000 acre feet of demand reduction from those programs. And honestly, I think through April, we've already seen about 3,700 acre feet. So this is a pretty conservative estimate. We may see more. And then at the bottom, what you can see in yellow, if you go all the way to the bottom, what it shows us is the potential amount of water we would have available for carryover for 2024. And so in the blue column, it shows about 50,000 acre feet. So if we want to keep 15,000 acre feet for 2024, that leaves us at the bottom there 35,000 acre feet of surplus water for other dry year water supply programs, exchanges, and I'll get into that a little bit more. In addition, I've got three different scenarios here to the right in the table. We're looking at a 50% state water project allocation in green, a potential 25% state water project allocation in yellow or in orange, and then the 5% worst case scenario in red. And so the details are all there, but it includes our assumptions moving forward with all the new PFAS and PFOA MCL assumptions. We have some wells coming online next year, so our production from our groundwater can increase if we need it to. So that assumes a full amount for next year. It also assumes the 15,000 acre feet of carryover available, and then shows how we would operate, you know, pending on that allocation and how much water we would have available for carryover the next year. So the goal is to have, you know, between 10 and 20,000 acre feet of carryover. So we get pretty close there in all these scenarios, even the worst case scenario. And really overall right now, knowing that there's an El Nino that we're shifting into El Nino, and all of the reservoirs are so full right now, there's a pretty low probability that we would end up in a 5% allocation. I think some pretty horrible things would have to happen, and I'm not going to say them because I don't want to jinx anything. Let's stay in this comfortable space of having more water than we need. So, but the scenario is there, and we would be able to manage that if indeed it did happen. So lots of information on that slide. So next I wanted to go into a little bit more detail real quick, just talking about how we are utilizing all of that imported water supply. So I've got a graphic here that kind of breaks it down. So we have our 100% allocation. Some of it goes to our local demands. The next, we've got 25,000 acre feet going to recharge our banking programs, and that's the maximum amount that we can do in 1 year. We're planning on keeping 15,000 acre feet in San Luis next year, and then we have that 35,000 acre feet of potential surplus supplies. And so currently we're trying to figure out, you know, what the best plan is for those surplus supplies. And we have three options available. We can look at exchange programs, we can look at water sales, or we can just keep all of it as Article 56 carryover for next year. So I'm going to walk you through these three options. The exchange programs is basically what we're really looking at. We have two potential partners right now. We've had some initial discussions with AVEC and Rosedale Rio Bravo, and we're going to continue moving forward. I think there's enough water to have programs with both of them if they're willing. And if if there's still extra water, you know, I've got my feelers out to see if we can find anybody else that would like to do some kind of an unbalanced exchange with us. The pros of these, an exchange program would be that it would create a future supply for us. So if it's a 2-for-1 deal, we give them 2 now, and hopefully some year when we need it back, we'll get that 1 acre foot back. So what it does is it extends the program of our, it extends the life of our banking programs. Which is great because, you know, like the Rosedale banking program is based on cycling 200,000 acre feet in and out. So it would definitely extend the life of that program. The cons are that there's potential recovery constraints and that we lose a portion of the water. So for every 2 acre feet, we lose one. And then with regards to recovery constraints, you know, in the past when we've done an exchange with AVEC and United, they had some restrictions, and in the agreement it was that we could only recover the water that was owed back to us if the allocation was a 30% or higher. And so those aren't necessarily the dry years where it's going to benefit us the most, but you never know, if there's an emergency or something happens, we may be able to utilize that. And 30% is really still fairly dry. Water sales are also an option that we've utilized in the past. Currently, we're not really looking at selling any water. So we don't really have any partners that we're talking with. The pros are that, you know, you can get additional revenue from a water sale. The cons right now is that we don't get any return water back in a dry year. And at this point, the price per acre foot is going to be so low, I don't think anybody's ever going to want to consider that. The hydrology is just so wet. And for example, even early on, there's so much water in the Kern, I think it's selling for $5 an acre foot. And if you recall, about a year ago, the water was being sold in the dry conditions for $2,000 to $2,500 per acre foot. So there's been a real shift in the price of water. And so we're not looking at that as an option right now, because I just don't, you know, it's not going to benefit us the most. The third option would be to save all of that surplus water for carryover supplies into the future. And so if we save that 35,000, we would end up having around 50,000 acre feet of carryover in San Luis at the beginning of next year. The pros of this is that that's a lot of water. It's potentially multiple years of supply that we could utilize. We can early in the year use it for exchanges or continue putting it into storage in the banks if our banking partners can take it. Cons are that there's just this huge high risk of spill. And so, and we just do not have enough demand to use this in addition to our table A for a year. You know, that's basically enough for us to use an entire year's worth of supply, if not more. And so if the hydrology with El Nino continues to be wet, which they say it will be, or people are planning for, you know, the chances of losing that water are very high, and we're not going to probably be able to move it as quick enough, and we may lose quite a big portion of it. So those are our three options. And right now we're sticking with kind of looking for some exchange partners and seeing what we can do with regards to that, because I think that right now is going to give us the most benefit for that water. But again, there's a lot of contractors that have a lot of water, so we'll see how that pans out. To be continued. And I think that's it. So if anyone has any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you. And, you know, any public comment? Sorry, great presentation. Committee members, comments, questions? President Martin.
Sarah, thank you for your presentation. You know, we talk about whiplash and weather effects, but not whiplash and the effects on staff activities, going from a preparation of where we're going to get our water to meet our needs to the next year, where we're going to put all the water we now have. But so that's recognized. I appreciate everything you do. Of course, you probably are aware, we got a comment last night from a board member asking staff, I think, to make sure that we can use all the water that is available to us. And I take you at your word that the 25,000 of putting water back in the banks is the maximum we can do.
Yep. I've talked to them. I've talked to the banking partners. And, you know, with regards to Rosedale, they're kind of situated between the CVP and the State Water Project, and they can actually get a lot of water from Kern. So they are recharging. They're planning on recharging water for the entire year. And at this point, they can't take anymore because they're getting so much from everywhere else. But they are interested in doing an exchange with us. And so they said 20,000 max for the banking program. And then, but they are willing to work with us to do an exchange because that adds more benefit to them. So versus just taking more and putting it in our bank. And yeah. Then I think Semi-Tropic, I spoke with them. They did say they could potentially take more, but we already have 6 years worth of water in Semi-Tropic. And I hesitate to put too much in there because of the constraints to take it out. You know, I mean, we're kind of limited with that. So I think there's better opportunities for us. And that's why I'm recommending just staying at the 5,000 right now.
Yeah, so I was going to say, I see that you're pulling all the levers that you have and trying to manage the whole situation. It's quite different than drought time, but we certainly appreciate all your efforts in trying to maximize our supply. Thank you. Thank you for that.
You're very welcome.
Dr. Cooper.
Yeah, sir. I thank you for the presentation, and we always like good news. It's more fun in shuffling water around than not finding water.
I don't know. Now it's making finding water seem easier.
I guess I'm a little disappointed in the AVEC thing. That they would only let us use the program if it's 30% or above. I would have thought that we could have gone down a little farther than that. 30% allocation is.
Yeah, it's higher, but recall, so that was in the agreement, but then in 2020, because the exchange happened in 2019. So in 2020, right when all of our wells went off for PFAS, we actually reached out to them and said, hey, would you be able to help us out? And that year, the allocation was 20%, and they were able to give us about, I think it was just under 1,500 acre feet. So it's kind of a set point, but there's no reason you can't ask and just say, would you be able to help us out? And so they were able to do that in 2020. And yeah, you know,
down to 20%, which would be a lot more valuable to us.
Yeah. But you know, they're trying to protect themselves too. So it's challenging when everyone's keeping those levels, you know?
And I just want to, on the AVEC thing, so that's not the groundwater banking program. That's a separate deal.
Oh, that's a separate.
Totally separate deal. It was an exchange deal that we did when we had some extra resources with them. And so,
yeah,
much different than the banking agreement that we're currently working on with them.
Okay. Oh, good, good. Well, and I agree with you. Putting $50,000 in carryover is too much to risk there. And there's some other, you know, if we could get 20,000 in carryover, it would be nice, but
yeah,
it's too much to risk. Good, very good. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Marks?
Great presentation, Sarah. Just another thought. Perhaps the water might have some value to a potential banking partner like AVEC, in terms of if we're paying to get the water out to them, maybe that could offset some of the development costs for the bank that we otherwise might have to incur. Just a thought as to something you might want to explore with them.
Okay, I might have to call you to explain that to me a little more. I know I've asked them if there was potential for us to do some of those early deliveries, kind of like we did with Semitropic when we knew we might be a banking partner and we sent the big slugs of water, and then that was grandfathered into the program. So trying to kind of explore some of those options as well. And then potentially have some secondary recovery capacity until we are officially banking partners in the program. So
sounds like great ideas to explore with them. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious. And please correct me if I'm wrong. So Devil's Den, is there potential for storage there? Or is it just too small,
too salty?
Well, what if we sell that water to farmers and then make space? Is that a possibility?
I imagine we're going to give water to the farmer this year if he wants.
The farmer has said that they want water, but they want water at $5 an acre foot, like the Kern water price. Mm-hmm. And it cost us about $40 to $50 per acre foot to move the water to him. So right now we're exploring potentially sending, we've looked at sending him Article 21, but it's kind of been interesting and tricky in that the original water order that I sent out at the beginning of the year always indicates that on 100% allocation, we might sell him Table A water. And so the trick with Article 21 is that you cannot supplement Table A water. And so we've already said we're sending him Table A. And so he would have to take the Table A on top of the Article 21 to get that. And so it's just kind of, it's kind of tricky. And there's really no, there's no requirement with the new lease for us to have to sell him water as we did in the past when we got to these higher allocations. So right now we're feeling that there's really more of a benefit for us to keep the water to benefit our district. Because if we put it into Devil's Den, we don't have any benefit of getting it back. It just benefits the farmer and he wants really, really cheap water.
I just want to add something to Sarah. The farmer's requirement is very small in comparing to the amount of water that we have. Yeah. We're talking about 200 acre feet a month. Sarah, is that correct? Something like that, or 100 acre feet a month?
I don't know. I think he wanted about 500 acre feet in total, but I didn't know. I don't know the rate that he wants it at. So.
It's a small amount in comparison.
It's a very small amount.
Okay. Thank you. No other comments from directors? President Martin?
Sarah, I have another question. It's kind of a different question, but the State Water Project reliability factor is an important number for us. How do these seasonal fluctuations affect that number?
That's a really good question. I believe, and Dirk, please correct me if I'm wrong. I believe that those numbers are coming from the CalSim models that are going to look at the historical hydrology. And the one thing with the CalSim models is that it won't take into account this year's hydrology probably until like another update from now. So right now, the CalSim data, I believe, goes to 2015. And so it's just started kind of encompassing the drought information that we had. I would think it would help it, but we also had such dry years recently. I don't know. I think it's all going to average out, and they're taking into account so many of the environmental factors and regulations and things like that. I don't know enough about CalSim to probably answer that question accurately, but that would be my best guess.
Okay, well, thank you, Sarah. Great presentation, and I guess we're going to be looking forward to your presentations every month.
I think this might be my last one for a little while. I don't know if there's any more information to give you. We can't get any more water.
Well, we like to hear good news.
I don't need 150% at this point. I will float away. I will definitely be coming back once we start getting information about the exchanges and things like that. But right now, we are maxed out on our water supplies. So,
excellent.
Okay, thank you very much.
Good job.
Thank you. All right, we move on to item 4.2, staff activities, presented by Mr. Al-Hassan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. And Yuni, if you can start some of the pictures. I wanted to have some pictures of the reports this time because we have a lot of activities over the last month and we visited so many places. So I just wanted to give a sense of some of these places visited, including Rosedale, including Edmundston. And I will start with, on April 19th, we visited Edmundston. We had a tour by state water contractors organized. We started the visit in the Department of Water Resources field office in Carlsbad, I think. The address is Carlsbad. In that visit, we met some of the people who are involved in the operations of all of the facilities in the southern part of the valley, and including Edmundston. And before heading to Edmundston, we visited some of the location, and we were exposed to their apprenticeship program. I think Steve and Matt presented to the board about how that program is have been established and how have helped and benefited the Department of Water Resources on maintaining and retaining their staff and developing them. We had one of the staff, I think, have been with the department for 30 years, and he have been a graduate of that program. And everyone involved in the tour who gave us the tour in Edmundston is a graduate of that apprenticeship program. So it seems like it's a very successful program. When we visited, we saw many of the students who have been trained to graduate. There is a different levels, and probably some of them are going to be graduating in a couple of in this year. After that, we visited Edmundston, and we were allowed to take pictures. Our group, I think, we have a special treatment. So just we have a couple of pictures. This is one of them. This is one of the pumps is taken out for repairment, and you can see, and you know. Going to the next picture, we can see that the size of things taken out, the motors and everything taken out of the of these pumps. Just to I stood near it so that we can get a perspective of how huge are those things. Next slide, next picture, please. Those are the staff who been in the special tour. Matt was in the other tour, so we didn't have the chance to take a picture with Matt Stone, who was also in this. And it was a really important visit for us to people who are, especially like Sarah and myself. This is our first time. Steve, I'm not sure if this is your first time, second time. So it was a great opportunity for us to connect with the facilities that provide water for us here in the valley. Next picture, please. And this is actually just a description of how approximately 2,000 lift that those pumps are responsible for bringing the water. And it's just the magnitude of energy, the magnitude of management, the magnitude of work. We just to go from the top of the pump to the lower level, it's about 6 stories. And we have to go that on stairs. So it was really a good exercise that day. I think every one of us had our steps that day. So next picture, please. And I think this is just one of the pumps that's we were, I think, at level 3 of the pump at that time. So it was a helpful, beneficial to have, you know, instead of imagining things, to go out there in the field and see the engineering work that provide water for us here in the valley. Next slide. On April 20th, we
I will stop here a little bit, but before going to the Rosedale visit, on April 20th, Steve and myself, we went to the Association of Water Agencies in Ventura County Water Symposium. And that's not related to the photo here. That was they were providing information about status of some of the Ventura County water adjudication cases. And the main takeaway for us was the role of mediation in these processes and how the mediator was able to work with different stakeholders. But the second part of the discussion was also in developing water policy direction outside of the adjudication, how communities, stakeholders, utilities could collaborate, how collaboration could help into reaching some of these agreements rather than going to the litigation and adjudication side of things. And they brought a couple of speakers. One of them was the lead for Northern California Water Association, and then someone from a retired director for California Department of Fish and Wildlife. And they were talking about how their collaboration have helped stakeholders reach some of the agreement and consensus on some of the achievements of managing their resources rather than going to the legal or litigation side. That was a very interesting presentation we had. We Steve and I agreed that we listened to some of very, really interesting presentations that day. Steve, if you want to add anything.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
So we'll keep going. On May 4th, and this is a picture about, we went and visited Rosedale Banking Partners. And the purpose for that was to learn about current operation challenges that they are going through right now, because I think Sarah was trying to talk to them most of the time. And we wanted to make sure that, first of all, we have the relationship, develop the relationship. We have been talking to them. I personally talked to a lot of them in Zoom meetings or Teams meetings. And this was the first time to go and visit with some of the people that we have started developing relationship with. And also to learn about some of their challenges. They were talking about how much water is available for them. And you can see around, and we took a tour in the facilities. They have water everywhere. Kern County is flowing at a significant amount. I think on Monday, the intertie was open for the first time, as I was reading in the news. And there is about 7,000 CFS flowing in Kern County now. That's expected to increase to 9,000 CFS by mid-June. So there will be a lot of water as the snow start melting. And so that's a challenge for them, because they have to take a lot of Kern County because some of their members are require them to take water and recharge it for them. And so the this year have a significant shift in their operations and how they are doing things. And we had a chance to learn from them of all of these challenges. We had a chance also, the next slide, if you go to it, and the next one also. We went to visit some of the facilities that we participated in construction. These are some of the drought supply wells and drought mitigation facilities that SCV Water have participated in contributed to develop. And we met with staff and we connected. I think, Steve, you have one thing you want to mention that at the end of that visit?
There was two takeaways. And all by all the ponds, there were thousands of frogs.
Oh, boy. Really?
The little just everywhere. So I don't know. That was an experience.
Just it's nighttime, I'll bet it's
I can't imagine the birds that are going to come in there and just go at it. But so that was one takeaway. And then the funnest takeaway is that Sarah made us all try cow tongue at a Basque restaurant at lunch.
In Bakersfield. That's so. Producer of. Yeah, I know where it's at.
Yeah. So that was a fun experience. But no, it was a really cool trip to see the spreading grounds in full tilt and the river flowing like it was, and just getting a chance to continue to build the relationships, as Ollie said. So it's cool.
Next picture, and then the next one. That's the last one for Rosedale. After that, we visited
Devil's Den. That was my first visit, and I think for many of our staff, it was the first visit. I think Rick was the only one who had been a regular visitor for that location. This is the location of our turnout from the aqueduct, and so we were lucky that day. We had a really good weather, and I think everyone was able to go out and enjoy the weather out in Devil's Den. Next slide, next picture. This is the aqueduct where we are taking our water from there to Devil's Den. And then we visited the site. We drove around, and one of the things that we observed that day is that the creek in the property is flowing, and there is a lot of water in that creek that day.
Really?
Yeah. And when we visited with the farmer, I think you can see it in the next picture. This is a creek. It was flowing, and you can see it in so many places. This is actually deep water. In other places, the farmer was saying that he's using the water from the creek now for irrigation.
Sure.
And he will continue using it until it's done. And I think with all the rain and all the snow that's melting, I don't think there is snow melting there, but I think with all the rain and the storms, it's just another source of water that's available for the farmer this year. Next. And this is the farmer's crop this year. I think he was saying that with all the rain and everything, it seems like it's a very good year for him. Still, he wants to continue growing in the area. He wants to continue growing until the end of the growing season, and that's why he was asking for the $5 acre foot water. In the back of the picture, you can see the Avenal Gap. That's what we talk about in our presentation. I think Rick, in the presentation, he talked about it. It's, you can see on to the right, you have some hills, and then to the left, you can see some hills, and in the middle, that's the gap that we're talking about that's separate the kind of the two basins in Devil's Den that we talked about last time when we gave the presentation about the kind of the two groundwater areas in this area. Then after that, May 9th to 11th, we have been in Aqua with almost everyone here in the room. We had a couple of meetings in Aqua. One of them was with Westside and Wheeler Ridge Maricopa, and that was they own the west side properties are mostly near Devil's Den, and for some time they wanted to know what we are planning to do with Devil's Den. So we had a chance to, first of all, there is new staff there. We wanted to know more about what the west side authority is doing, and they wanted to know what we are planning to do with Devil's Den. And as we are discussing things, we get to know that both Westside and Wheeler Ridge Maricopa had developed solar in their properties. And so one of the things that we're reaching out to them to know some of the consultants who helped them in developing some of these solar ideas, and wanted to get some of the information so that we can reach out to the consultants. And because some of these consultants are very familiar with the location, and including Devil's Den. And that was one of the good meetings that we have with some of the partners and some in the past. I think we have provided some water to Westside, as I understand. And so that's kind of me reconfirming our relationship with them so that if there is any chances for water exchange, we will be able to do it next year, hopefully. We met also with Rosedale again, and in that meeting, we were talking about exchange opportunities for this year. That's where we are hoping in the next couple of weeks, we'll be able to have an exchange agreement working with them to put that in place so that we'll be able to exchange water when we're able to do that. The last meeting we had in Aqua is with EVAC, and we get a status update for the phase two that EVAC is planning to do now. Phase one is almost finishing, and as you know, phase one is entirely for MET, And so then now they're looking into phase two, where it includes other partners. And they are now planning for kind of phase 2A, which is a feasibility study that will reaffirm some of the issues that us Santa Clarita Valley raised for them when we received the initial responses from them for our questions. And some of these questions is mainly about reaffirming with Department of Water Resources capacity for the conveyance capacity, as well as they wanted to confirm their banking capacity also through groundwater model. And so that's something that we'll be contributing and participating with them. My last item is going to be talking about the release that we have that United have from Cascade. So if you can go, this is a picture of, to the right, you can see this is Cascade Creek. To the left, this is Santa Clara River. I wanted to credit these pictures. Some of the pictures in the past photos, I want to credit to Sarah. Sarah actually took some of the pictures in Rosedale and Edmundston. These pictures for the release for United are the credit for Paul Hoover from our staff, who went out with our drone and took these pictures from the drone. And actually, we will end up with a video for this. So what's happening with United release, and Uni, you can go through the slides and the pictures. You can see this is the creek, water in the creek, and then it's going to be merging with Santa Clara River. And you can see the water measurement that day, they have done it into Santa Clara River because the flow was steady and small. They couldn't do it in Cascade because the flow was very high and was very, they couldn't find a place that they can take measurements that day. So they ended up taking measurements on Santa Clara River only. But what's happening is that the DWR granted a extension of the release timing for, instead of May 1st, ending in May 1st, granted United another month until the end of May to release flood flows that's stored in Cascade Lake to the Cascade Creek and then to reach United. So they are allowed the maximum of 460 CFS. That's the maximum that allowed them for the release. And the total amount of release should not exceed 28,000 acre feet. That's they're going to release between now and end of May. So any volume that come as late flood flows or any volume of previously accumulated storage that's not released by June 1st, it will become a property of the state of California. And so that's where we are following with the United. United are doing the measurements. Probably there is a measurement next week. I'm planning to go out with them. And if staff also would like to go, we'll go and see the measurements. I had a chance to talk to United staff today, and he said that he went back again and did a couple of measurements. And he was saying that the flow between the lagoon from Cascade Lake, Cascade Lagoon, to the bridge at 126, he estimated that there is a loss of 30 CFS, which means that's recharge. And so that's what he measures recently, I think about 2 days ago. And so next week when we go, we're going to affirm some of these measurements again. With that, that's the end of my report. I can just leave this. This is going to run for a couple of minutes. Heading upstream in the Santa Clara River.
Very soothing.
I need some music.
Yeah, maybe a little nice music.
It's good. Any comments from the public?
Santa Clara River. Yes.
Do we have any virtual attendance right
here? Just staff.
Just staff. Directors, Dr. Mark.
We were talking with the folks of River Valley about an exchange of. Are those discussions on the poles with everybody kind of busy trying to manage all the water that we have? Or
Yes. we're continuing to meet. What we found out was the relationship between Irvine and Rosedale and us, right? It's almost a three-party relationship in the way the bank works and some of the facilities and specifically capacity of extraction and conveyance. Rosedale was wanting to make sure that that arrangement was not going to impact other contractual obligations that they had. So what we decided to do, we were talking to Irvine kind of one-on-one. We have now brought that into a three-way discussion with Rosedale, ourselves, and Irvine. And so I think right now the exchange that we're looking at will probably just be one normal, you know, two for one with Rosedale and not doing it with Irvine. They have taken in their maximum amount, I think, of recharge that they can in their program contractually. So, yeah, so I think we're still learning some of the lay of the land there and how those arrangements work. We've taken the opportunity to present kind of the status of our resources to that three-party group. Rosedale has presented some of the operational constraints to the group, and still to go here is Irvine presenting kind of their view of the world on their program and how it fits into all those pieces. So still having, you know, active discussions and learning a lot, but yeah, as far as the exchange with them, we're not moving forward with that right now.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Excellent report. Thank you. I appreciate that, and I'm sure people appreciated being able to get out to Edmundston treatment plant or pumping plant. It's amazing. I'd like to get the board out there again someday. We did it years ago, and you know, it at one time was the highest water lift in the world, and I think the Japanese built one that was a little bit higher, but that place uses more power than the entire city county of San Francisco, if they had all pumps on. Mm-hmm. It's a huge power consumption.
It's crazy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's
a lot.
14,000, 80,000 horsepower pumps.
And they even have a generator that they fire up to be able to start their motors, mm-hmm. So that they don't pull the grid down when they start. It's an amazing engineering.
I have a question.
Thank you,
Alan. So with this increase of precipitation, we're seeing a lot of vegetation around Santa Clarita. Yeah, not expecting a lot of rain during the summertime, summer season. Are we still communicating with the LA Fire Department, and are they still holding regular exercises with their tanks at our Rio plant?
I'm not sure, but we can follow up. That if you get a hold of Keith, that will be his
fortune.
His okay. group, yeah, okay. Yeah, that would probably be the best way. And I'm happy to follow up with Keith.
I'll contact Keith myself. Mm-hmm. All right, thank you for the presentation. No other questions or comments from committee. Let's move on. Item 5.1, status of SCB Water Agency's water saving targets presented by Mr. Dickens.
Yes, hello. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yes.
All right. Thank you, Chair Ozerhofsky and members of the committee. I'm Matt Dickens, and I'll be sharing an update on the status of SCB Water's water saving targets. Okay, so tonight's presentation will provide some discussion on history and definitions, status of the current project, that's the bringing the water saving targets to all divisions and legacy divisions and integrating with our customer information system. We'll have an overview of initial findings. I'll share some of the issues and challenges that we are working through and developing solutions on. Finally, I'll review our next steps, and then we'll conclude with questions and comments. Okay, so history of water saving targets in the SCV. So initially, these water budgets, if you will, were recommended in the 2008 SCV Family of Water Suppliers Water Use Efficiency Strategic Plan. This was pre-SCV water merge and pre-CLWA update of the Water Use Efficiency Strategic Plan. So initially, it identified several measures, including development of water budgets. With that, Valencia Water Company launched Residential Water Smart Allocation Program in 2011 with the use of tiered rates that were approved by the California Public Utilities Commission. That was then followed up with a dedicated irrigation metered water smart allocation program at Valencia Water Company that was also negotiated and with the CPUC, which has a different, I make that case because when tiered rates are used, there's a different regulatory framework for investor-owned utilities and public agencies that must comply with Prop 218 requirements. And then at Newhall County Water District launched its version of the program called Water Efficiency Targets in 2013. The tiered rates structures were transitioned to the single quantity rate, meaning the single rate per unit of water. So the tiered rates were transitioned to one rate per unit of water structures prior to SCV water launch in 2018. And then WASA, the Water Smart Allocation and the Water Efficiency Target programs were maintained by SCV water until the CIS systems were integrated in 2022. So, you know, what are water savings targets? Well, they're often referred to as water budgets. That is that it takes a efficient level of water usage need for indoor and outdoor characteristics for residential customers. And outdoor characteristics for landscape customers, they're specific to that customer's parcel, home, and dedicated irrigation landscaped area. And basically what they do is you create these water budgets to using efficient levels of water, and then you compare that to actual water consumption. So they're most often used with residential and landscape customers. Sometimes with multifamily customers, they can be used, and far less common with commercial, industrial, institutional. And that's because typically those types of customers have very different types of water consumption, that it's very complicated to develop a agency-wide water budget that meets all the various types of services and functions and industrial process water uses that different customer classes in the CII sector have. But again, they establish water use efficiency benchmarks based on unique property and customer class characteristics. They provide consistent water conservation and water use efficiency communication to water users by comparing actual water use to the water saving target. This is done so on the bill, and customers can also access this information on the website and by accessing their account. It does enable water agencies to identify anomalous water trends and prioritize engagement and programmatic expression. That is that if we can identify customers with water usage that significantly exceeds the monthly water saving target, then we can develop customized engagement education material to help that customer solve that issue, if that issue is indeed a function of some sort of leak or over-irrigation or something along those lines. And again, they're often used with tiered rate structures, although that's not necessarily the entire, not all water budgets are used with tiered rate structures. So how does it work for us? Well, currently, you know, we're in transition to AMI from AMR, that's advanced, the automated meter reading, to the advanced metering infrastructure. But essentially what you can see here is you got residential kind of budgets that are based off of number of people, gallons per person per day, number of billing days in the cycle, measurements of their landscape properties, and then, you know, using some efficient water, landscape water need calculation. Similar to dedicated irrigation, we measure we identify the meter, we identify what landscape that meter waters, and then we're able to say in this period of time how much water they need. So we read meters that goes into our that usage goes into our customer information system, and then we have residential indoor and outdoor water budgets, and we have dedicated irrigation. This is goes into the water saving target system. It got cut off here in my picture. That uses real-time weather data from the Sima Station 204, and it goes back to the customer information system, populated on the bill, and then identified on the website using this kind of percent of your water saving target. And then customers are informed, and then they can make decisions about how much water they're using and what kind of efficiency improvements they may want to implement, or programs from the agency they may want to participate in to have their water consumption move from an inefficient, excessive, or wasteful category to either super efficient or efficient. So turning to the status of our current water saving project, well, as you remember from my presentation, or you may recall from my presentation regarding AB 1668 and SB 606, the state of California is going to require us to have urban water use objectives on an annual basis. In 2021, they did provide landscape aerial measurements for all of our customer classes. And so with that, SCB Water started integrating into a single customer information system all of our legacy divisions. First, it was Valencia was in Encuesta, Legacy Valencia, then Legacy Newhall went into Encuesta, which is a CIS system, and then Santa Clarita last year. So now all divisions are housed in the same and managed in the same customer information system. So once that occurred, SCB Water, our conservation sustainability team, contracted with DCSE. That's the contractor and consultant that we use to develop the proprietary system at Valencia and Newhall, and have had great success with their tools and their support for many years with that system. And so we contracted with DCSE in August 2022 to implement phases 1A and 1B, and also 1C, which is as is noticed here. Phase 1A, I'm proud to say, is completed in May of 2022, and we're currently testing that in the training environment. Phase 1B will be completed in June 2022, and 1C, once the finalization of the state's urban water use objective standards and methodology are released. So here you can see what this means. So for our legacy divisions, Newhall, Santa Clarita, and Valencia, we had water budgets for Newhall Residential and Valencia Residential and DIM. And now with the completion of Phase 1A, we have residential water efficiency targets in our training system, in our training environment for all legacy divisions. We then need to add dedicated irrigation meters for Newhall and Santa Clarita water divisions in phases 1B. And then once those are completed, we can then also incorporate the data from the state to develop and complete our urban water use objectives, which means that we're going to be able to track in monthly billing cycles or daily or periodically, we're going to be able to track water consumption within these sectors relative to their urban water use objectives in real time so that we can make informed decisions and use that as a performance management system to direct our engagement and communication with the public. Again, here's the legacy divisions, the agency residential budget, the agency dedicated irrigation metered budget, and then kind of what the urban water use objectives through legislation and recommendations are. I'm not going to go through everything, but basically what you can see is that, you know, for the most part, we're able to, one benefit of the states providing us with the landscape area measurement for residential customers is that measuring these properties and residential landscapes is a fairly resource intensive effort. Newhall used CSUN GIS grad students, I believe, or at least CSUN GIS students to map their area. Valencia Water had staff map their area, and I can tell you that when that staff person was completed with the mapping project, after mapping 26,000 homes, they left to Hawaii right away. I haven't heard from them since. So I can tell you it's a pretty resource intensive effort. So, you know, Santa Clarita is about, it's larger than Valencia. And so that's a lot of homes. We're able to utilize for free what DWR provided us for landscape aerial measurements. So with that, though, we now have several different methodologies, several different ways that these are measured. And so now we're trying to bring those, dovetail those together so that we can have a more uniform system in order to develop, you know, meet our standards. I should also note that we do not have aerial mapping done for Newhall and Santa Clarita for the dedicated irrigation meters. And where residential budgets and measurement is a very difficult process, it's far simpler than measuring dedicated irrigation meters. And you can imagine why. Typically, your home is going to have a parcel. It's going to be located in that parcel. It has four corners, and ergo, you can measure everything inside of that. When you get to dedicated irrigation metering, you'll have an irrigation meter, and then you'll have lots of landscape area that without having those landscape plans, you're not really sure exactly what that meter irrigates without having to go and turn on every station. And you can imagine how complicated that would be doing that 2,000 times. So we're working on developing processes to help us develop a sound solution, but one that engages our community to help us get that information, considering they have a lot of institutional knowledge with our customers. So, okay, so what are our initial findings? Well, you know, what we did for residential, we haven't done this for dedicated irrigation meter yet. As I showed you, that was kind of phase 1B. But we were able to take a look at the actual residential consumption from 2018 through 2022. This is agency-wide, and we were able to look at that usage compared to an agency-derived budget, that is utilizing our legacy standards and methodologies, and then compared to what we know currently to be the state's budget process. However, the caveat here that needs to be mentioned is that the state has not finalized its standards and methodologies. This is just based off of what they released at their workshop in April. This tells me something somewhat concerning, though. As you can see, residential usage typically is below agency-derived budgets by about from a range of about 14 to 7%. That's pretty good. That means our customers, based off of those legacy standards and methodologies for efficiency calculations, they're performing better than that. And that makes sense because those were developed in 2010. We've since gone through SBX 7-7, and customers have started embedding a lot of efficiency in their usage. So this kind of suggests that the agency-derived budgets might be a little bit dated and need to be updated to match current standards and current efficiency capabilities. So the next piece of what I would notice is that residential use, while it's less than the agency derived budget, it's more than the state budget. And for this urban water use objective, this creates a problem. And the range is pretty significant. You can see it ranges from about 400 million gallons in 2018 to 2021. You're looking at about 800 million gallons over what the state budget was allocating, or 16%. Fortunately, we were below the the state budget in 2022. But remember, we had a water shortage contingency stage 2 plan in effect. So we saved about 16% since from May through December, expect us to be about 6% below what the budget was for the state that year. What this tells me is we've got two issues. One, our budgets that we're communicating out to the public are probably inaccurate and are too liberal, and that the state budget is significantly requires more conservation, and we need to address those issues empirically within the budget and through policy decisions. So some of the things that we found when we were conducting our analysis that we are working internally to understand, but also to work with the state and preparing and documenting, This issue right here is what I call residential and CII dim overlap. And so in this case, you can see that the LAM data that the DWR provided was about 15,000 square feet, this parcel here, which is expanded on here. But clearly you can see this wall, which is their property boundary. This other area is irrigated by a dedicated irrigation meter that belongs to either the Homeowner Association or the city, in this case, probably the HOA. So DWR's numbers that they provided to us give 15,000 square feet, when in actuality, the customer is watering about 2,900 square feet. That's a challenge because, again, our usage is already exceeding the state budget as we know them. So we're going to need to be pulling back those square footages in all these areas where overlap occurs. And you can see all the parcels where that overlap occurs. Now, fortunately, once we subtract from the residential sector, we will then add that landscape area to the CII DIM, which has a very similar water budget. So it should balance out. But if we're going to communicate these water budgets down to our customers effectively, we need to make sure that they're based off of, you know, known credible data, not this parcel-based data, which is, kind of a mix between their property and CII. So those aggregate areas will be equal in the objective, but they must be allocated by class to effectively communicate the budget or the target. Here you can see the area that I'm talking about that's outside of their property boundary. So another issue that we found is called distortion, and this happens when you overlay a two-dimensional image on a three-dimensional or three-dimensional boundaries on two-dimensional. So you can just kind of see here that the parcel is capturing pretty much most of the property, except that it's skewed. It's captured some of it, this neighbor's property is inside of it here. And then over here, this is probably some of their property. But then look at near the street, you have landscaped area that's outside the parcel boundary. This is about 7% of this customer's landscaped area that is not being allocated by the state. So this is a benefit to us if we can accurately account for these areas. But again, that's a challenge when you're talking about 60,000 accounts that we have to go through and conduct this. But that's about 7 to 11% of this area and those areas that are impacted. So that's another issue. And this kind of shows you where those areas outside of the parcel are that are not calculated in the state's budget, but would be calculated in ours. Another issue are parkway strips. Parkway strips are located outside of the property boundary. Here you can see this area with all these parkway strips. This is kind of an issue that's more common in older areas within our service territory. The DWR's landscape area measurements do not include landscape area. So these are technically not classified as residential. They're not classified as CII either. They might be classified as institutional. We're trying to get information and discussion with the DWR folks and the State Water Board to figure out how to account for these. It could be that these fall into the non-functional turf definition, of which the California State Legislature is currently considering legislation. But nonetheless, you can see these are sizable areas outside of the parcel. DWR gave us landscape area measurements inside the parcel. So other issues that we found are CII DIM, that's Commercial Industrial Institutional Dedicated Irrigation Meter Measurements for legacy New Holland Santa Clara customers. We may want to consider a factor approach, that is learning what we've learned from the Valencia legacy system, applying that to dedicated irrigation meter, and then working with those account managers and account owners to help us true up that process and true up the actual landscape area measurements. So the state is planning to provide some support, but it may be some time before that is ready for use. We also need to take into account slope correction factors. Our community has a lot of topography. If you're looking straight down at it, you might be looking at a hill that's at an angle, and you're going to give it some less, maybe 11-12% less area if you don't
Nickens, can you hold on for a minute? We have some technical issues.
Matt, I think you are having some Wi-Fi issues on your side.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah. We lost a sentence or two.
Yeah, I'm in my office here, and I'm actually having to use my hotspot from my phone because I'm having internet issues in my office. So I apologize for that. Maybe I turn off
we're losing you again, Matt.
Turn off the video to help. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
All right. I'm at the office having some internet latency issues. I apologize for that. I was talking about slope correction factors. Just to be clear, you guys can hear me okay?
Yes. Go on.
Okay. So slope correction factors could be another 11% that we should account for in those areas that are impacted by slopes. DWR process procedures for maintenance. One of the challenges that we foresee is that every time DWR provides us with updated data, they're going to provide us the same data in the same paradigm. So we're going to have to make sure that we retain our knowledge while also having a process to accurately compare and contrast what the DWR's LAM landscape area measurement are. And then we also need to run scenarios to identify agency budget methodologies or target methodologies for target calculations. Those should probably be updated to conform to current irrigation efficiency standards, opportunities, and those that are attainable in order to align better with the state's urban water use objectives. Okay, lastly, next steps. We're going to complete phase 1B, which is the CII DIM landscape area measurements. We'll incorporate the finalized state methodologies, which is phase 1C. We will develop the agency methodologies and run test scenarios to determine the impact on our customers' consumption and feasibility analysis. We will test this in training environment before we push to production. We'll also conduct public engagement education to inform the public of the water saving targets, the values to the public, and also the process of which customers can request a variance. If for some reason the agency's data as it's collected and identified is incorrect, it can be easily updated with a variance request. Once the public education piece is done, we'll move to production. That's called go live. We'll document our maintenance and training, and then we will use the system for performance management and then start working towards expanding its capacity with not just monthly billing, but in alignment with our AMI daily water measurement and daily metering capabilities. So a lot of great opportunities with this system, and it really helps customers get a great handle on their water usage and water efficiency opportunities so they can make decisions to improve their water use efficiency and lower their water costs. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Matt. Anyone virtually? Committee members, questions, comments, remarks?
Hey, Matt. Thank you for the presentation. This will be new to you, but my understanding is that that TWR is saying our new irrigation budget based on some geospatial averaging, and that's fine, but the issue being that our CINES station measures ET significantly higher than that. So how do you see that being resolved if we are, eventually going to be asking our customers to be living within a water budget on a month-by-month basis? And we've got TWR telling us we've got a lower budget than would be suggested by our measurements at our Simmons station.
Now, Director Marks, thank you for that question. And to just quickly again clarify, the issue here as you've outlined is that Station 204, which is a point station up at the Rio Vista Water Treatment Plant, measures evapotranspiration data as part of the CIMIS California Irrigation Management Information System. Since that station was in operation, the state has launched a spatial CIMIS capability that utilizes satellite data to take certain information from Station 204 and spatially apply it to other areas of our service area using solation data from the satellite overfly. And it is true that that data is coming in when it's extrapolated out or expressed out in the spatial CIMIS process. That's coming in about 10% or a little bit more, maybe 12% lower than what the Station 204 is showing at that position. And that situation is one that we can certainly make a case for. However, you know, current communication with DWR suggests that they're fairly confident in the spatial CIMIS process and that this is something they intend to deploy statewide. And many water agencies have already transitioned to spatial CIMIS as opposed to the point CIMIS. So, however, what I think that we can do is we may have a tough argument making the spatial CIMIS or challenging the validity of spatial CIMIS, but what we can do is pick up other ways to kind of decrease that delta. And so we're looking at those strategies to try to understand if we have a 10 to 12% difference or deviation or delta between 204 and the CIMIS average across the valley, because we do know that weather patterns change from here and there, that they're different across the valley. That makes some sense. But they're also giving us measurements that don't incorporate things that it should, like slope correction factor, which happens to be 12%. So I think that there's ways that we can use data, use the information we're collecting to help build back a case that we should be enhancing or expanding our current landscape area measurements that conform and comport with our local demographics and topography.
I fully agree with you that we ought to be pursuing greater accuracy in those areas. I'm questioning, are we going to be able to get real-time spatial CIMIS data and be able to communicate that to our customers?
Gotcha. The answer to that is yes.
I was curious about that because, you know, to create, we've got a CIMIS station and we maintain it and we know what it is on a day-to-day basis. But if you're telling me the state could have the infrastructure to provide us with the spatially average data,
That would be
to use that then.
Yes. Yeah, Director Marks, so phase two of this process will be not only integrating with AMI capabilities, but integrating the spatial CIMIS data so that various different zip codes that are impacted by that spatial CIMIS will be reflected in their water budget. So we're going to enhance the measurement of ET and express that out through the system. That brings up another good question, though. While we have spatial CIMIS data, we really don't have spatial precipitation data. which is another thing the state is requiring us to do, which is to offset in our evapotranspiration. We are supposed to take 25% of annual precipitation and subtract that from that evapotranspiration data as well. And so that's going to be a little bit more complicated, but we're looking at solutions on how to express that, include that in our budget our target calculations as well.
Great to hear. Thank you.
President Martin. Matt, I just, it's very interesting to see the technology that's behind all this and efforts made, I guess, to improve the accuracy. What are our current bills based on as far as the efficiency number? I mean, how is all that, if you can do that in just like 25 words or less?
they are based off of, for lack of a better term, they are based off of essentially the model water efficient landscapes ordinance standards that were applicable around 2010.
But as far as the areas and so forth, is that based on the same aerial?
There were two different methodologies that were, there's three different methodologies. The first one was they were hand measured at Valencia by staff. At Newhall, they worked with CSUN GIS students to measure. And then in this effort, DWR provided landscape area measurements to all urban water suppliers across the state.
Okay, thank you.
Question about parcels. What if a residential home consists of two parcels? How do you account for that? Let's say a residential house is made up of two parcels. Both parcels belong to that, particular landowner.
Yeah, we would have to combine them. The issue that we typically see is the other way, where we have one parcel with multiple homes on it. That's typically the issue that we see, and that's because often when new communities are built, the parcel layer from the county was essentially the whole development, like the whole community section. And it hasn't been parsed up. And so you end up getting, 30 or 40 homes on one parcel. And then we have to go in there and break it up into subunits.
Okay. And then all of this is contingent upon all meters being AMI? You have to wait until all meters are changed to AMI?
No. Director Osrahovsky, that's a good question. When all the meters are AMI, we will be able to communicate real-time water usage data compared to the water efficiency target for that billing period. Right now, what happens is we gather that data for the billing period, and then the customer gets a bill showing them what their water usage was compared to what their water need was. And so they can't make any corrections to historical use. They can only make corrections to the next bill. So when we have AMI, which by the way, that first process is better. That's years, eons above anything we've had before. It's great consumer information. At least you can make changes. But in AMI world, when you're getting daily reads, you can also get daily target data. So you would know 3 days into your billing cycle, if you're greatly exceeding your target, you can make changes in the billing cycle so that your bill pens out more what you're hoping to, rather than getting a high bill and being like, well, shoot, now I'm going to go and change my irrigation timers or fix the leak or whatever. You'll be able to do it in real time rather than in arrears.
Understood. Thank you.
Matt, the issue of parkways, even though the homeowner doesn't own the parkway, they're required to maintain and landscape the parkways. So that really needs to go with the parcel that it's attached to.
I concur, Director Cooper. I'm not sure how the state is to respond to this, but we are making the case we are making that case. I am somewhat concerned that if that case isn't made, then that area becomes classified as institutional. And if you look at the non-functional turf bans, they exclude or exempt residential, but industrial, institutional, commercial, HOA, common interest developments are all impacted by these non-functional turf bans. This could be an issue that's pushing those areas into that bin. But we want to make the case that if they are irrigated by the residential customer, that they should be included in the residential customer parcel.
And when they measure these parcels, they don't do it off of the tax bill, do they? Because I know, like, my tax bill, living in a community that I do, show that I have 2/3 of an acre. Well, I don't have anywhere close to that. But it's what it is you're paying taxes on other property within your development. So, I hope they're using actual GIS data and not tax bill data.
Well, they're using parcel data, which is essentially tax bill data. And that I showed one case where there's overlap, where that customer's home was irrigated. Their parcel boundary was 24,000 square feet, but their home and their landscape property was more around 6,000 square feet. The other area was irrigated by and maintained by the HOA. Those are issues that we have to figure out and parse out. In areas that don't match like that, so say, for example, you live on a large lot, but only half of it's irrigated, it wouldn't, the state has created three categories to measure landscape areas. They call them II, which is irrigated and irrigable, INI, which is irrigable but not irrigated, and then there's NI, which is not irrigated. So if 60% of your parcel is not irrigated, it's not going to be included in your urban water use efficiency target. It's going to be called NI. The only thing that they are going to include is II, the irrigated and irrigable. And currently they propose to allow 20% of your irrigable, not irrigated area in that calculation.
Yeah, using the tax bills, I can see where you have a slope and you're only using part of it and the HOA is watering the other half. But like I said, where mine is it shows 2/3 of an acre.
Right.
Parcel, there is no parcel there that's 2/3 of an acre. What it's doing is you're paying taxes for the park and the tennis courts and the other things that are within your development. So, you can't use the tax bills on private developments.
Yeah, they just give us the parcel. But we've seen some areas that are exacerbated to that case. I have some parcels in our system that show 500,000 square feet. And if you look at the county parcel, it's about what it is, but the home on it is only your typical kind of house with 5,000 square feet of landscape. So in that case, they're still telling us that that has 500,000 square feet, but it's only giving the water, urban water use objective to the landscape area that is, or the area in that parcel that's being irrigated, when 20% that's considered INI.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Matt Dickens. Looking forward to future updates on this.
Thank you very much, Director Arthur Hosky and members of the committee.
All right, we'll move on to item 6, committee plan calendar presented by Mr. Cole. Mr. Cole?
Yeah, it's just there for the committee's review. I don't have anything specific to point out tonight.
Okay, so look at June 14th. So I think it's going to be a pretty busy committee meeting.
Yeah, and some of those will fall off for sure. Like the AVEC MOU is going to take some more time. So
okay.
Yeah, it'll get shuffled.
And we're pretty confident about presenting recommendation number 2 and acting stage 1?
Yes, we are confident on that one.
Okay. And just like Ms. Flory mentioned, status of water supplies is not going to be presented anymore throughout the year, I see.
Well,
We'll have a presentation when we finalize some of the exchange that we are planning to do.
Okay.
So we'll come back again probably July or August.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions, comments from the directors? We move to item 7, adjournment. Thank you, everyone. And have a good weekend.
Yeah, thank you.
Everybody's adjourned.